And you guys are a bit of Philistines. You don't talk about, like, literature much, right? Like, books?
Yeah, not really.
Book on tape.
Wordies.
Good for you. Good. It's good that you don't. Most times are pretty boring.
Welcome to another episode of the MacGuffin Podcast, the movie review podcast that dreams are made of. Keith Foster, you are my co-host from San Diego, California.
That's right. Cassidy Robinson, you are my co-host from Los Angeles, California. And we have a special guest today. Why don't you go and introduce him, Cassidy?
Patrick from Almost Educational, friend of the show, Patrick. Reoccurring guest, first time on the MacGuffin Podcast.
Right.
So
yes, yeah.
A voice from real America, the Rust Belt.
our Midwest representation from Detroit, Michigan.
Like Detroit adjacent now. I can't take credit that I don't live in the city proper anymore. I have a podcast called Almost Educational. I'm a teacher. I co-host with my teacher friend, Dennis. Sometimes when I can corral them, it's a podcast in which we sit down typically with anything in the classroom that we cannot bring because of curriculum issues and talk it to death. Like the next podcast is all about like, what if John Dewey and public education never took hold in America and we had a privatized system, much like healthcare? What would privatized public public education. What would public education? What would education look like if it was privatized by Betsy DeVos?
Right.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Well, we'll see.
Give it some time.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting show. We always shout it out at the end here with our list of friends. And I've been on a couple times. Keith's been on a couple times. And I highly recommend people listen to it. It's a good yell at your stereo kind of podcast.
Yeah, we have lots of bad takes. If you want to hear lots of bad takes on all sorts of issues, that's why it's Almost Educational.
Yeah.
Some of it's tongue-in-cheek, like purposefully done as like devil's advocate. Like I would say I support about 60% of what I say in the show. the rest of it is just playing devil's advocate to the co-host.
That's fine.
Great.
That's fine. That's a lot of what happens on here as well.
Hey.
You were telling me, Patrick, before we started recording that you were going back and talking about the conventions you've been to and how you're slowly becoming like an angrier old man who just wants to go look through the used bins and have everyone leave him alone.
Yeah, I guess if I put you guys in an age group, you'd be millennials.
Sure. Yeah.
And I don't.
I think we're technically Zennials, no, but we're not. Like we're right on the cusp, right?
No, I think we're technically closer to the cusp of Gen X than closer to Zennial.
Well, I am definitely Gen X, and I think I see that more now as I get older, and I've gone to cons, and I'm also happy I can swear on the show more. Like I don't give a fuck about the cosplay kids and like. Even the celebrity guests, like, have become so curmudgeonly. Mm. I just see those long boxes, and I just run to them, start looking through them, like, feverishly. Oh. The best thing you said last week, Keith, was when you were talking about Sunday.
Yeah.
You're like, that's when everything's half price. And I was nodding along on my run, like, yep, that's the only time you should go is Sunday. Like, the rest of it's all nonsense.
Yeah, fair enough. And just as a reminder to all of our listeners, if you want to go back and listen to our last episode, we did all of our WonderCon coverage, talked about the panels and the, exclusive stuff that we saw there. It was a fun time and I'm glad we got to go. I don't know that much about the Tri-Cities, Comic-Conning experience though.
Oh, well, Tri-Cities. Now you said Tri-Cities.
I'm sure that was inaccurate, right?
Yeah. That would be Flint. That would be Flint, Saginaw, Detroit.
Okay. Closer than I thought.
You were much closer than you thought, except for, like, I would not consider Saginaw a city, even though they consider themselves a city. But there is Grand Rapids on the west side of the state. So mm-hmm. there used to be two big conventions in Metro Detroit. There used to be the Motor City Con and the Detroit Comic Con. And like they interchanged depending on like what company would sponsor them of like the quality it would be.
Oh, sure.
And yeah. And whoever took over, whoever does WonderCon in San Diego do the Motor City Comic Con now. Mm-hmm. Oh, and it's okay. become, the only problem is now it's become a little too pricey to go to.
Yeah.
Like the tickets, you can still get in for a day for like, I think $40.
Oh, man. I mean, you don't even bother looking up the price tag for San Diego Comic-Con for a day. It's stupid expensive now. It's like every year we're like, I guess.
I can imagine. Like you used to be able to go to like C2E2 in Chicago, which is about a half a day's drive. Same with Toronto if you go to TCAF and the Comic Expo up there. But those have become impossible. I mean, just like, and like there's no... First of all, the crush of people is too much. Mm-hmm. And I know I kind of made a joke about like the dirty old man looking in long boxes. But a lot of what I'm interested in, like getting sketches and meeting like Ryan Brown or like some kind of comic artist, are so pushed into corners now.
Yeah.
That like it doesn't feel very worth it for me to go to it. I feel very lost and old and like confused when I go. I just don't like it. It's not a good experience anymore.
That's funny because I think that like C2E2 and like Emerald City Comic Con, those are the ones that I still I think are still a lot more friendly for like artists and writers.
C2E2 definitely is.
Yeah, whereas like San Diego and like a lot of the comic people, they get like the same people year after year after year, which right. is fine. You know, it's okay, but like it's not usually people I'm excited about at this point. Although I will say I am always excited to see, I'm going to mess up his name. The guy who does Mouse Guard, he always has a tiny little booth, and I've bought a shirt from him for like 6 years. Because he always has a new Mouse Guard shirt. And so I have this extensive collection of specifically Mouse Guard shirts that nobody knows what they are.
Right.
He lives pretty close to me.
Oh, really?
Like physically, yeah, in the state. I might have moved, but like physically pretty close to me, yeah.
Interesting.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, he used to do public signings at like public libraries around here a lot. I forget his name, too. I feel like a jerk now.
It's Brandon something. Brandon Peterson?
That sounds right. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we've done all this comic book talk. The reason that we're having you on, Patrick, is today we're going to be reviewing Shazam. Mm. And
not Captain Marvel.
Nice segue.
Not Captain Marvel. Well, I mean, technically Captain Marvel, but not by title. And at the end of the program, we're going to be doing a Netflix homework that you suggested, Patrick, The Battered Bastards of Baseball, a documentary that Netflix released. And that's what's on the agenda. But before we
Peterson.
There you go.
Yeah. Thank you.
David Peterson.
Before we move on, let's go ahead and get into a little consume obey. I guess you could do that live. Do you want to do it live?
Well, I guess. Listen. Here we go, folks. I didn't realize how clearly you could hear my voice come through when I recorded it. That now you know that's very much me when I do it. Like, I thought I had, like, audio modified it a lot more. I was like, oh, it's just me with, like, reverb. So, ready? Consume, obey. There you go.
That's fun. That's what all of our drops were. It's just a little delay and a little reverb. And I'll let you start, Patrick, since you've never done this segment with us before. What are you watching? What are you listening to? What are you reading? What are you obsessed with?
Okay, in the theme of comic books, I went back and reread all of Brian Wood's DMZ from Vertigo Comics.
Oh, like, okay.
All 70 issues. I loved it when it first came out, and it went from, I think, 2006 to 2012. It had like a 6-year run. And the premise is it's the second American Civil War that just kind of pops up all over the country. And it's not really clear as to whose side is on whose side. There's not like clear lines of like Mason-Dixon line separates things. But there is a DMZ and it is Manhattan. And the whole premise of the book takes place with this Maddie. Ooh, I forget his last name. I think it's Maddie Ross. But I'm not quite sure. They refer to him as Maddie. He's a journalist who gets thrown down in the DMZ and is reporting from the DMZ during the war. The book as a whole, the whole series doesn't hold up as well as I thought it did. It has a lot more I thought it would hold up a lot more to like our political landscape today, being a divided country. But it's got a lot more, I think, parallels to the Iraq War and, you know, empire building than it does American domestic politics. Like, closer towards 2012, he gets a little more explicit with the political commentary. And the other problem I had was the art kind of drastically changes over time.
I hate that.
Yeah. And it's mostly the coloring. I don't think it's a lot of the artists. I think Vertigo went to a different coloring house. And maybe someone does ink. Like, the digital inking, I think, is what kills a lot of comics in a certain period. And it just gets muddy and ugly. And, I think Brian Wood kind of loses the thread there near the end. Mm-hmm. Like, it goes on too long. And you're like, okay, just wrap things. It could have used 50 issues instead of 72.
Gotcha. Yeah.
When did this come out? Like, what years?
2006 to 2012.
Okay. Yeah. So that was very, like, specifically in that period, that was when digital inking really, like, came into its own.
Yeah, and they moved away from it, I think, with the two big, to the big two, and then all the others kind of followed. And unless you, I think, do all of it, like, you're on your own, like you're Sean Murphy, you write it and draw it and do everything.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a thing anymore. Mm. I think it's kind of anachronistic. But it's a nice thing to see the evolution of comic book art within a series. And
digital inking has gotten so much better with the way an iPad has upgraded between 2006 and now. It's insane.
I think that's – you hit it on the point. I think they kind of – realized that the digital market was their new market.
Yeah.
And what they had wasn't translating either to the glossy, you know, floppy, nor was it translating to the digital. And whatever shift they made was post 2011, everything gets cleaner. But there's that experimental phase, 2007, 2011, especially Marvel comics are you're just reading black inks and there's an occasional red and yellow that pop up in it.
Yeah, that was actually the prime of when I was collecting, was that exact that period of time. It was 2005 through 2011 or so. Mm. Yeah. I was reading a lot of Batman, though, so it's mostly just black. Just everything's black and then a little bit of muted color here or there.
Yeah.
Okay, Keith, what about you?
So in anticipation for the new season of Game of Thrones, we've started going back and rewatching Game of Thrones. We got started too late to go all the way back. So we just picked it up from the Battle of the Bastards. And so we're just kind of recapping this last season before the new season comes out, the final season of Game of Thrones. So that's exciting. Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's fun to sort of revisit that world and
see all the characters that died.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you do a lot of who's this guy again? Because I did that when I rewatched all of it.
Because we didn't, we didn't rewatch the whole thing. So we just picked it up from basically the last couple episodes of season 6. And now we're into season 7. And there's some stuff that I'm like, oh, yeah, how did they end up with, how did these characters end up here? And, oh, what was going on there again? So there was a little bit of that, but that's kind of why we wanted to rewatch at least some of it.
Yeah, fair enough. And this is, how many seasons did it go? Eight? Seven, eight?
Yeah, this is the eighth season. And season 7 and season 8 are both a little shorter in episode count, but the episodes also get much longer. So it's a show.
It is a show. There are episodes on television. Mine is something a little bit different than I usually do. I found a Twitter account that I'm having a lot of fun with right now.
Oh, interesting.
And it's called Film Clickbait, where they just retweet obnoxious clickbait film articles from different various websites, and then they just caption it with what's obviously in the piece.
Okay.
So that doesn't do it justice. Let me read a couple of these. It says, comicbook.com says, It looks like Avengers Endgame tickets might be going on very soon. And they caption it with, no other information is given beyond that. Just that tickets for a movie are opening in 1 month. Might be going on sale soon. And then here's one here. It says, from Heroic Hollywood, Avengers Endgame poster reveals the fate of Lolita Wright's Shuri. And then they just caption with, she died. what's one of my favorites? From Comic Book Resource, how Disney's live-action Dumbo gets its name. And then they caption it with, film blogging. Go to a movie, come home, write several hundred words describing a moment from the first act with no insight, press publish. And then the last one here that I'll read off. Where was it? Zack Snyder reveals Batman v Superman Ultimate Edition existed before the theatrical cut. That's how editing works. So I highly recommend film clickbait as a way to keep up with stories that shouldn't have been written in the first place.
Oh man, there's so many of them. It's bad.
It's bad
out there.
Just from my 8 months of doing film journalism, I know that there isn't that much to release, really. So every day you got to come up with bullshit that has no reason to be released. And that is a Consumo Bay. For complete hypocrisy, we're going to talk about the movie news.
There you go. Perfect. I'll play the role of synopsis on Twitter here after you finish reading. No, I'm not going to do that.
Okay. So these are some fairly exciting stories, I thought. Macon Blair, who is the lead actor in the movies Green Room, or one of the lead actors in Green Room, the lead actor in Blue Ruin, he is going to direct they're calling it a mainstream Toxic Avenger reboot. So the famous trauma film, famous exploitation film from the 80s, Toxic Avenger, is getting a remake. Pretty weird choice, but in this day and age, are we surprised?
No, not at all. I mean, sure. You know, everybody wants their... Ever since X-Men, man, the first X-Men movie, everybody's wanted their piece of the superhero pie. It has the word Avenger in the title, so of course it would attract something. So Macon Blair, he's only directed that Netflix movie we reviewed. I don't know how to live in this world anymore or whatever.
Yeah, which I had mixed feelings on, but I thought was, you know, a decent first film.
Yeah,
is that the Elijah film one?
Yeah,
Elijah Wood.
I think he's fine enough as a director. I enjoyed that movie, I think, more than you did. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the tone really fits Toxic Avenger. Just the idea of trying to make something so clearly exploitation into mainstream, I'm not super into. It feels a little dirty.
I'm sorry. Can I split hairs for one second?
Go ahead.
Sure.
We're calling this... I don't consider that exploitation. That's schlock to me.
I think exploitation.
Okay. Interesting.
And I think that's a completely dead genre for a long time. And I don't know how you revive that. And schlock became so mainstreamed in terms of bad films. You get what I'm saying? Like with Mystery Theater 3000 and... Mm-hmm. I don't know who is the audience for that movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Other than stoned 14 me. Oh, that's awesome. But otherwise, there's no one else who would like that movie.
Well, yeah, but there is the question
of... will it be awesome? If it's going to be produced by Legendary, it's either going to be, I think... if you're going to do that, do it as direct to Netflix... try to do a genre parody. If this was in the vein of Black Dynamite, we might be talking, but it sounds like they're not going the right route for it.
Yeah, it sounds like they're just going to try and have you ever seen those drawings where they do the anatomically correct, weird, super realistic Pokemon?
Yeah. Yes.
This is kind of that, or what I assume that's going to be. where it's like, it is the Toxic Avenger, but it has convincing special effects and maybe a darker tone. Now, I'm just basing this on the fact that the one other movie we've seen by this director and the fact that he comes from the Jeremy Saulnier world of these kind of like dark thrillers. Maybe he has another, like a funny bone in him, and he can tap into something else. And I don't want to assume that he doesn't, but I have not seen evidence of that.
But even like, I don't belong in this world. I'm not at home. I'm not home world enough anymore.
E.T. go home. Sure.
Even that, like, it had sort of a quirky sense of humor, but
a little bit more so than the Saulnier movies, for sure.
But it's not the same sense of humor as like a former trauma guy, James Gunn. Like, I just don't see it working. I think it's going to be kind of a buried release. It'll probably come out in January or February. Nobody will give a shit. And I guess it's fine.
Okay. So that's happening. I'll keep my eye out, especially for a trailer. That's actually one where I might want to see the trailer first. Joel Coen of the Coen brothers is going to solo direct a Macbeth remake or adaptation with Frances McDormand and Denzel Washington for A24.
Okay. I mean, didn't we just get a Macbeth with Michael Fassbender? And
yeah, they do this about every 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I guess fine. I don't know. I'm not terribly interested, to be honest. I think Frances McDormand as Lady Macbeth is like the most interesting thing about this to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're more of a theater guy than I am, and probably read more Shakespeare or seen more adaptations than I have. Where does Macbeth, or the Scottish play, rank amongst the works of the Bard for you?
Oh, for me? I mean, top five, for sure. I love the play. I love... I think it's one of his better works that weaves sort of supernatural mysticism into an actual story. I think without getting too weird, better than some of his other stuff. It's definitely up there for me. I don't know. I think it takes something really special to make Shakespeare translate to film for me,
right?
Because it's, I mean, that's not really the medium it's intended for. Mm-hmm. Other than, you know, Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, like, not a lot stick out to me. I did like that Ian McKellen Richard III. That was pretty good.
That was not bad.
That was pretty decent. I think Kenneth Branagh, he's done some notable ones.
It's good, but I would always, always prefer to see it live.
What about you, Patrick? Do you have an opinion?
I have taught Macbeth instead of Hamlet. I find Hamlet's very difficult to teach to high school kids. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I think Keith hit on it when he said like both plays have a very not mystical but like philosophical subtext to it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the further you find yourself sitting down and trying to describe like the concept of fate. Macbeth's about fate. Like, he's fated to do the things that are pretended to be done. And they can see that pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. Where Hamlet is a little more in the subtext, and like it takes a lot of explaining and taking away from the play. And a play that usually takes 3 weeks to do mm-hmm. with the kids takes 5 or 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. Even Romeo and Juliet, which a lot of times they try to, you know, cram it down in like a 9th grade curriculum. If you don't delve in anything, you can keep it pretty surface level. But like they enjoy the adaptations of both the Branagh version that's set during, I think, like Soviet Russia, like Stalin's late Soviet Russia. And the other one was the Fassbender one. It's in Scotland.
Of Macbeth, pretty true to, right?
Yeah, yeah. Of Macbeth. And they enjoy both of those, both play acting them in class, which is, oh my God, which is really difficult to do.
And when you're and then have popcorn reading the play.
Oh, yeah. Dude. Oh, yeah. You have no idea.
I have an idea. I went to high school.
Yeah, so there you go. But they really, really like watching the the Fassbender version a lot.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I never saw really that one. Well.
It's good.
I've never seen that one. I heard it's violent.
It's super violent.
Richard went and saw that. I think he actually reviewed it on Jabber and the Drone. Have you ever shown them Kurosawa's Throne of Blood?
No, I thought of it before. Because we read, what's it called? I'm gonna blank on it. It's a Rashomon type story. I think it's called it's a story told from a detective's point of view, mm-hmm. A man who kills a woman's point of view, and the woman whose husband who's killed. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember the name of it. It's like in a field or something like that.
But it takes that Rashomon POV kind of thing.
Exactly. When you try teaching POV and storytelling, and I've thought of doing it before. But again, I've only got one of the reasons we do the podcast is I've only got so much time in a curriculum to fit a film in. Even if I show a half hour's worth, mm-hmm. that I can't make a lesson plan for it. I'm just too lazy, to be quite honest with you. I've thought of it a bunch of times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that Throne of Blood specifically plays to a modern audience, because it's such a culturally different take. With it being a samurai film. I'm cool with this. I'm cool with the, I'm interested to see how Joel Coen does without Ethan there. Like, does that change the flavor of what the Coen brothers do? I'm interested. Yeah. I like A24. That's a company I trust, generally. Cast sounds cool. And it is one of my more favorite Shakespeare adaptations. So, we'll see. I'm not super excited about it, but it seems like they got a really solid pedigree.
Yeah. I mean, that's all true. I just, again, I'm not chomping at the bit. But yeah, I'm sure it will be fine. I'm sure the quality will be whatever.
Yeah, we'll see. You know what people are excited about, because we got a lot of response on our Facebook group about this. The live action Cowboy Bebop series has now cast John Cho as the lead.
Yeah. I've seen mixed reactions. It's usually the reaction I see the most is I think people are excited for John Cho. I think he's good casting for Spike. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people are also hesitant to see any adaptation of Cowboy Bebop. I think it, as far as the anime world goes, it's mm-hmm. it's one of those series that's revered as perfection, basically, because it's
like the anime equivalent of adapting Watchmen,
kind of. But I think a little different than that, because it's shorter. It's pretty concise. It's a pretty consumable series. Mm-hmm. So it's not that the problem is too much mythos. I think the problem is that it was just the right show at the right time. The music was such an integral part of it. And I think there's just a lot of, we've felt it over certain adaptations of things where we're just okay, but why? I'm not super beholden to the original anime, and yeah. I think the cast does sound exciting. I thought it was a movie, not a series. So, I don't know. I'm curious.
Are you super familiar with Cowboy Bebop, Patrick?
I have almost zero, other than Akira and that one that's the one that takes place with a space race, 1987 movie. My anime and manga in general is so surface level. I mean, so surface level. Mm-hmm. I know what Cowboy Bebop is. It takes place on a space station, and they're bounty hunters.
Yeah,
and I know it's popular because it's popular with people younger than me, especially. But mm-hmm. other than that, I couldn't tell you anything.
Well, it came on to Adult Swim. I think
early 2000s.
We were still in high school for sure, and. And it was it's one of those shows that I think is sold a lot based on its mood. It definitely hits sort of the right mix of humor and melancholy and noir. And I think it's just, one of those things where it has a huge fan base, and that fan base, they just would rather rewatch the anime, I think. Mm-hmm. But I will say, I think it's cool that they finally cast an Asian in an anime as an anime lead, especially a character like Spike, who's sort of the epitome of casual cool.
Right.
So it was based off of a character from the 70s, I think. I can't remember. It's like a detective. Hold on. I have to look it up real quick.
Like from a Japanese property or American?
Japanese, I think.
Oh, I wouldn't.
I think it's a 70s show called
Lupin the Third. That's the only thing I know.
There was some influence by Lupin the Third, which was another anime. But the character of Spike Spiegelman was directly based on the main character Tentei. I'm gonna butcher this. I apologize. I'm trying to not be offensive here. Tentei Monogatari
sounds right.
It's a character that was based off like a 70s Japanese detective who heavily influenced this character. So I think it's only like fair that, you know, you cast another Asian, and I don't know John Cho's actual nationality. So I'm trying not to.
It's okay. Keep digging.
I'm trying. Anyway. I just think it's cool that they finally cast an Asian as...
in an anime adaptation.
Yeah.
As opposed to the Ghost in the Shell remake that just happened and the Death Note remake. See, that's my red flag.
John Cho is Korean, by the way.
Oh, Korean. Oh, okay. Korean-American, okay. Probably, yeah. For me, that's my red flag. So we have yet to see a really great live-action adaptation of anime. It's not as bad as the video game to film curse, but pretty close.
I think it might work better as a series. I think that might be something that they can spend a little more time focusing on, like, the story and the characters. And honestly, I think if anything could be, would probably be something like Cowboy Bebop. I'll say I'm cautiously optimistic.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, if it's on Netflix, you can give it the 3-episode try.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, let's go ahead and start talking about these movies. And Keith, why don't you go ahead and describe to us what happens in Shazam?
Shazam!
You have to say it with an exclamation point.
Well, it's literally how it's written. That's how it's credited on IMDb. So if you don't, you're ignoring the filmmaker's wishes. Okay, so the basic story is there is this foster runaway kid, Billy Batson. He's sort of a troublemaker, sort of a ne'er-do-well, keeps running away from foster homes, pulling tricks on the police, that sort of thing, to try and find his actual birth mother. He gets placed in a foster home. It's sort of a large home with a very diverse group of young kids. He feels like he doesn't belong. And then seemingly out of nowhere, after defending one of his foster brothers, he's like running away from some bullies. He ends up on this train and magically gets transported into the lair of the wizard Shazam, who's been defeated by his enemies. He only has one chance left to find a champion. So he chooses Billy Batson, having no other options left, who becomes the titular hero, Shazam, which is played by Zachary Levi.
Whenever he transforms.
Yeah, so he says the magic word, he transforms, and Shazam says the magic word, transforms back into Billy Batson. So him and his new foster brother discover his powers. They sort of figure out what everything he can do. What being a superhero means, and then a villain comes along and ruins everybody's day. That's probably enough of a setup, right?
Yeah, that works for me. Patrick,
I'm always bad at those.
Since you're our resident comic book guy on this episode, how much did you know about Shazam as a character, aka Captain Marvel? There was a television series in the 70s, I think.
Oof, there was. With the premise being an old man picks up in a van and gets some powers legitimately. Yeah.
So even more creepy than the mysterious wizard.
Even more, yeah.
So what's your take on the character?
I mean, it's the same as I think. I'm sure the general public's knowledge of him is like Injustice, like some kind of video game character. Mm-hmm. For me, it was always like Billy Batson as Captain Marvel. I have to correct myself and call him Shazam now because it's the Shazam family, not the Marvel family.
Yeah.
But the idea of him as a character, I always found very appealing. But finding him in print post probably 1982 was very difficult to do. And so you'd always get him as a guest star who would show up, Justice League International was how I knew him. And which is a very funny series by Kevin Maguire, which took place as an international Justice League in the late 80s, early 90s. And he was the comic relief to comic relief. I mean, he was the funniest character in it.
Really? Okay.
I thought so. I mean, like, because he was, you know, just so, he's the big cheese. I mean, he's always been a cheesy character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting to me because I thought the choice to make this more of a comedic film was like an obvious departure from the character because he's one of those characters that always seemed like he could just never quite crack out of the golden age.
Yes, but I think they purposely held a thumb on him in the Golden Age.
Yeah, okay.
Because I think DC was so worried how the character translated. The long history is, Fawcett Comics was an independent comic company from 1940 to 1970s, I think. Mm-hmm. And they basically only published the Marvel family. The Captain Marvel and Mary Marvel and Freddie Freeman, who was Captain Marvel Jr. And if you go back and actually read those Fawcett comics, the art's much better than you think any kind of comic book from the Golden Age and Silver Age would be. Mm-hmm. And B, the stories are actually really fun. And like, they know how stupid comic books are as a concept and like a superhero is. And they're pretty happy to play with that stuff. I think DC got a hold of it in the 70s and 80s and was kind of like, ooh, this is a little radioactive. It's not where we're going to go with things post-crisis here. I don't know where he fits in things. We're going to kind of, ghetto you off in your own, like, Fawcett universe. And so they've always had, like, this arm's-length relationship with him. But he works so well. I think if anyone's ever read comic books in general, probably Kingdom Come is how most people would know Captain Marvel, Shazam, as the very creepy character in Kingdom Come, where like Billy Batson never changes back. But like he'll pop up every now and then in like his own series, which are really good. Judd Winnick had one that was like Superman and Batman, Superman and Captain Marvel First Thunder, which is like a mini series. And Jerry Ordway had a series that was really good. But to long story short, my relationship with him is arm's length, always wanting more, but that's kind of how you get it. I mean, mm-hmm. you never get, only until recently has there been, I think, a series that's gone on longer than maybe 12 issues. Because they kind of re-embraced it like, okay, bang, pow, comics are for kids again, I guess. We need some kind of new audience here with something. Mm-hmm. And we're going to purposely try to make it more towards a young audience. But I'd say it's much better for all ages.
So and I think that resonates with the movie pretty well. Sure. Like I think
definitely.
I think whoever walked into Warner Brothers' office and just like I can just picture it. Somebody bursts in, right? Cool. They're like the secretary Pamela. She's like, "Are you here for the 12 o'clock meeting?" And he just walks past her. Oh. He kicks the doors open. He slams a binder on the table and he says, "Superman meets Big," and he just got a round of applause. Everyone gave him a standing ovation. Like, just conceptually it works so well. Mm-hmm. Because the superhero genre is so audiences are so familiar with it at this point. Mm-hmm. That to play with it and to in a way that is both self-referential and not, I think, was a really smart move on DC's part.
Well, I agree. Here, I'm talking about as a film now. Like, my expectations going into this, I'd love to hear what your two takes are on this, too. We're probably pretty low, but I was excited to see what would happen. Even if it was a train wreck, it'd be a fun train wreck to see what they would do with it. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a property. Mm-hmm. But, like, everything I knew about, like, I knew it was in developmental hell since Dwayne Johnson, who's executive producer on it, wanted to do, like, a Black Adam, which is, like, an offshoot of Captain Marvel, Shazam. And I knew that, like, since 2014, and no one knew when this movie was coming out. I heard at one point it had a team of writers on it, which is never a good sign.
Yeah.
I knew there was a horror director who was going to direct it. And I was like, oh my God. Like, I just imagine a million horrible, like, I was like, well, it's going to be really bad. Like, the more I heard, and I keep a pretty good embargo on, like, watching trailers and teasers and reading any, like, plot points on it. So I went in pretty fresh eyed to it in terms of, like, whatever I thought was going to be. And I'll save after I hear what you guys came in, you know, thinking and what your final take on was it, but I had probably guarded expectations going into the movie.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I saw the trailer and I think the trailer did a pretty good job of capturing, like, what the tone of this movie would be.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. I think I'll kind of compare it to Bumblebee, which we reviewed back in December. Click our archives to check that out. But in that, this is also, like, it's intentionally aimed at, I think, a slightly younger audience.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Which I don't think is a bad thing. Like, I think it's okay to remember that, like, comic books can still appeal to kids. They don't all have to be nightmarish brood monsters. They don't all have to be, especially in DC's case, they don't all have to be like Aquaman's fucking 18-part symphony of weirdness. it was nice to have just, at least my impression, it was nice to just have sort of a stripped down, simple, like, superhero just being a superhero. But that juxtaposition of, you know, he's actually a 14-year-old boy, I thought was really fun to watch. And generally, the movie was pretty funny.
Yeah, I agree. I feel very similarly in that. I thought that the trailer, I was sold by the trailer. I laughed at the trailer, which rarely happens. And I think that it just gave me just enough to make me interested. And I said, you know, I usually am not, like, super pumped about whenever I see a DC movie trailer, but this one actually, like, felt like removed enough from the DCEU, which they say they're trying to kind of walk away from now,
which I think is smart. Especially after watching this, because I see how it's like, I liked that Batman and Superman were character, like, not characters, but, like,
they exist in this world.
Yes, yeah, exactly. But we don't need to know what version. I mean, it's definitely implied that it's the DCEU versions, but it's not specific. It's just like, yes, Batman and Superman are real. They're a thing. But we're not going to get bogged down
It's not married in canon.
Yes, exactly.
And you don't have to try and connect the dots throughout the entire thing, which is nice. I do think that it is definitely skewing younger. Mm-hmm. And in a way that I think is successful. I mean, the principal leads are children, and really good little actors too. We have the one kid from It, played Eddie Kasprak.
Ah, that's what I knew him from.
Yeah, Jack Dylan Grazer.
Was he Freddie Freeman, the best buddy of
the one with the cane? Yeah, he's really, really good in this. I mean, he's been really good in everything so far. So hopefully, he's able to, like, go through puberty and keep a career, because I think he's a good actor.
Right.
That's one thing I was going to say. I will say is, if they are going to work on a sequel, get it out now, because you only have.
Yeah.
You don't have long before these kids.
4 years, maybe. Asher Angel, who plays Billy Batson, is really good. Never seen him in anything before.
Younger. I think she's playing like 18.
Yeah.
And she's not so obviously older distracted. But, I mean, yes, she's...
So I thought all the cast generally is really good. You have Mark Strong as the villain doing the Mark Strong thing. But it feels in a way... Yeah, I think I'm about to say what you're thinking. It feels like they're tapping into the Mark Strong thing, Like, yes, they know that he plays this character. And since the whole thing is a little satirical, not overtly, but a little, I think they're kind of typecasting on purpose.
Oh, for sure. But I think they let him have enough fun with it. Mm. And I actually really like the way they set him up as a villain. Like,
yeah, they actually, well, one of the cool things about it on a script level, and I think works really, really well, and it keeps it from just being, you know, blank man for the 21st century,
right,
is that we have this cool dual character dynamic between the villain and the hero, where they're both dealing with stuff in their family, and they have kind of a similar pathos, but they, you know, they go separate directions in their morality and how they deal with feeling abandoned by their family. So thematically, the movie works, which is more than I was expecting, actually, that the movie is about something. That's always nice. I like it when my movies are about something. And I thought that stuff worked. It all takes place during Christmas, so I was getting a little bit of seasonal dysphoria. But
same.
I think it's going to be a great Christmas movie because it's all about family and coming together and giving, and you know, they're not allowed to say with great power comes great responsibility, but that is one of the underlying messages of the movie.
There's a few Marvel jokes that I wish they could have made. I obviously understand why they couldn't, but I wanted them to make a Captain Marvel joke, just because that history is so weird and like, I wanted them to be playful with it, but I get obviously why they couldn't.
There's some legal stuff there.
You get sued, buddy.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah. I wanted them to make like a God of Thunder joke. Like, I wanted all these Marvel jokes, but again, I understand why they can't. One thing I want to say about this before we go too far into the story, while we're still talking about cast a little bit.
Spoiler-free, right?
Huh?
We're still spoiler-free, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I don't think there's many spoilers to tell, but go ahead.
I think there's actually a pretty significant one, but we'll get there in a minute. I think Jack Dylan Grazer's great as Freddie Freeman. The rest of the family's great, but really, I think this movie kind of lives and dies off of Zachary Levi's performance.
Yeah,
he's so fucking good in it. He's able to channel that like 14-year-old energy. Like, I never believed he was an adult, you know. And I mean, perfect casting for that.
Which is what you brought up, Big. And they even have a little like wink and a nod reference to Big in the movie. He's doing kind of the similar thing that Tom Hanks did, where he's kind of child acting as an adult in a way that's really effective and
really fun to watch. He's so funny and charming, and his chemistry with Jack Dylan Grazer is great. Mm-hmm. because again a lot of his sort of character arc is based off of this friendship with Freddie Freeman. So I think it's worth noting, like, I think the cast really sells what might not have worked otherwise.
How about you, Patrick?
I'm going to be honest. Like, I was I like this like 1,000 times more than I ever thought I would. Like, I had a big ass-eating grin on my face the entire time. Not just because, like, I mean, if they had Talking Tawny, like the actual tiger with a jetpack pop out at some point, like there's a magical character in the series called Talking Tawny. Spoiler alert, he's not in the film. That like guys,
they do a nice little Easter egg for him though. Yeah, right.
But like, everything else, I mean, they did a great job of picking all these like disparate parts of his backstory, putting it in there. The best part, making this a good family film, I would say, not just aimed at a younger audience, that I when I watched it, I was like, man, there's a lot of tonal shifts going on in this movie. Like, it's really jerking me around.
Yeah.
In a lot of places. But they get away with it because it's a very honest tonal shifts of being a moody teenager. It feels like you're a moody teenager going through this journey with the kid, through everything. But I was going to spoil this stuff. I don't want to say things. But like, no, I mean, I was the child acting. I was really worried about, to be honest with you, too. Mm-hmm. Like, because in the trailers, you saw a lot of Zach Levy, you know, being big and imposing Captain Marvel, where they show him. And thank God everything's shot in light. There's lots of daytime shots. Yes. And everything's at night. And yes. Everyone's sad and brooding. And it's raining all the time. It's very DC. Very, like, a lot of this is stolen, I think, from Marvel pastiches, too, of, like, shoot the guy in the daytime. Shoot the whole costume. Who cares how big and padded the shoulders look? Mm-hmm. They're supposed to look big and padded. He's a kid who becomes a superhero, too. He should look awkward being huge and muscular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He looks awkward being huge and muscular. Like, everything's sold. Everything I worried was going to be a weak point in the movie, from tonal shifts to the way the child actors would portray things in it, were all the strengths, I think. And I think the stuff that I thought was going to be really strong were kind of weak. Like, Dr. Savannah is, I mean, he's Mark Strong chewing the scenery, as we kind of said before. Yeah. But, like, again, it fits the tone of the film. Like if they try to go, like, deep into that after that 1974 incident and try to explain the pathology of why he's doing what he's doing and, like, that whole Institute of Monsters he was developing or whatever. Like, if they got too deep into that stuff, like, it would be Batman versus Superman where, like, there's just so many subplots going on.
So since you brought that up, I actually liked the way the script dealt with those issues. At first, I was a little thrown off by how long it sort of took us to get to the main story and to get to Billy and stuff. But by the end of the movie, I was really glad they did that because they laid all the work down for Dr. Savannah so that it was like, okay, here's our villain. Here's all his stuff. And then that's kind of out of the way for a while. Now we can deal with our hero and really just have fun with that and establish this really fun world before we bring this villain back and sort of crashing into Billy's world. Like, we know he's scary. We know he's a threat, but we're not going to focus the whole movie on him. We're going to get his stuff out of the way pretty quickly and efficiently and then get to the fun stuff and, like, live in that world for a while before we really have to deal with that conflict. And at first I was a little thrown by that while I was watching the movie. Cause I was like, okay, when are we getting to the Shazam? Right.
Right.
But then, like, once we get there, we just get to live in it. So I really liked it later on. I was like, that's a great choice to just get all the lay that groundwork so that story can come back later. And we can spend the whole second act in just this playful world, with some great gags.
I agree. I have a criticism that I want to, use as a question to pose to both of you.
Okay.
That has to do with, the way the villain is portrayed. Mm-hmm. Generally, like the movie a lot, I think mostly it works. I do think there is sometimes where the tonal shifts are a little jarring. And I didn't know, actually, until I was just looking it up right now, that this is the same director who's done, like, Annabelle movies and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But that kind of makes sense now, because I think, you know, there's, like, kind of three shifts in this movie.
Yes.
I think. Oh, yeah. I think there's kind of like a standard superhero thing that fits very much into sort of the modern Marvel DC dichotomies and, like, how those kind of movies are made. And, you know, we put the action here, we establish the character here, these are his goals, Joseph Campbell, blah, blah, blah. So that's happening. And I think for the most part working. Then there is something that's kind of skewing a little bit younger, and it feels a little bit more kind of like a wish fulfillment kind of child fantasy thing, like sort of like reminding me of stuff like Pagemaster at times. And I don't mean that in a bad thing, in a bad way at all. I think that's a tone that's kind of been lost in film for a while. Movies made for, like, the 7 to 12 year old. I think that's all happening. And then it goes from that, I think somewhat jarringly, into, I guess, horror light stuff with the stone demons who are possessing Mark Strong, and they're, like, throwing people.
No, they're scary as shit.
Are you talking about the boardroom scene specifically?
Yeah, throwing people out of windows and biting people's heads off. And, you know, me personally, I'm fine with all of that. But there was some times where I'm like, okay, that's a little weird. And then when it comes to the satire aspect of it, some of it kind of reminds me of either, like, Deadpool light or Kick-Ass light. And
I was afraid I would get more Kick-Ass from it than I did. And I'm glad for that. I think that, yeah, we didn't really need that kind of tone. It is a little nod and winky the way Deadpool is, but even then,
it's not as break the fourth wall or whatever, but it does have that sort of tone sometimes of like, it's a superhero movie about superhero movies. But I guess the question I wanted to ask is, we have that first sequence, that really long sequence where it introduces our villain first as a kid in the 70s, and the very, I would say, a very kind of realistic and somewhat difficult to watch a car accident sequence. And then it, you know, goes from that into, you know, Billy Batson running around, getting in trouble, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it, you know, the tone dramatically shifts lighter. Do you guys think that that was on purpose, that they wanted to have the first scene, the sort of prologue, be like what we're used to seeing in the DCEU? And then they're saying, but it's not going to be like that, so don't worry.
I do.
Do you think that that's knowing?
I think it felt knowing. If it didn't, I think it was a happy accident. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what I was talking about when I, like, that sequence threw me off at first, and that transition threw me off. But
it's well staged and dramatically impactful, but then not really in tune with the rest of the movie.
No, but I actually think that's a strong point. Mm-hmm. I think it actually works to the movie's benefit, because by the time the credits were rolling, I felt like I knew everything about this villain, and he was such a credible threat. Like, he felt like he belonged in the world of Batman v Superman.
Exactly.
And so when he comes crashing down on Billy Batson's world, I think he was a lot less cookie cutter of a villain because of it. And he actually seemed pretty scary, because we've seen him do some evil shit at this point. Mm-hmm. So for me, that totally worked by the end of the movie. I was aware of the transitions when they were happening. I was a little thrown by them, but I was like, okay, let's see where this is going. And yeah, I think it worked for me. But anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, Patrick. You're fine. Patrick?
No, that's fine. I didn't even think about that, to be quite honest. So you just said that it might have been a purposeful jab at the company. Mm-hmm. I'll date myself with age again here, but like, I remember going to see in the theater Ghostbusters, the original Ghostbusters, sure, yeah, with my parents, and being so freaked out by the opening scene in the library.
Yeah.
Because it was so scary for the rest of the movie that like I ran out of the theater, and like everyone laughed at me and stuff like that. But I literally got up and ran out of the theater.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
It's like a five-year-old
kid. That's like a movie scene in and of itself.
Yeah. But like, there's a lot of movies, if you go back and watch them and think about it, and I'm not just saying like Ghostbusters era, but lots of eras movies were like the beginnings. I think that's a kind of a cinematic trick of these family movies, where like the beginnings really, really scary, and it creates like, puts the kids on edge, especially because I didn't know what was gonna have the rest of that movie after that, both times. But no, I didn't think so. I just thought it was, I mean, there was those dark tonal shifts, those horror tone shifts that I think are a little uneven. I think more like the family drama stuff was a lot more like,
yeah,
realistic gut punch, like, I don't want to spoil what they were.
That was
a lot more jarring.
Yeah.
Where you could see a lot of very confused kids' faces at a couple points.
See, that was actually the stuff that worked for me the least. Was
I thought it was pretty effective, but I don't know if me.
The stuff with his, like Billy's backstory, and the stuff with his actual mom, his birth mother, that to me, that stuff felt like it was, I don't know, it was strange. Like, that stuff felt like it was almost glossed over to me. Like, we have to get this out of the way so that he has some pathos. And then that was one of my knocks for the movie, was I didn't, like,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
I think that you have to have that in order for the Mark Strong stuff to feel no, effective, right, like the way that those two play off of each other.
I think you need it, but I just, to me, it didn't feel like it worked as well. Like, I felt like the stuff with his foster brothers and sisters worked. I was a little iffy on the parents, the foster parents, But then, like, the stuff with his mom, I get why it needs to be there story-wise. Mm-hmm. I just think that it could have played out differently. I don't know if it was
there was a sequence where they replay one sequence from two different perspectives, and I thought that was really emotionally impactful. I actually got a little choked up at that point.
Me too, buddy.
Me too.
That one. Lost Sawdust in that theater.
Yeah. Oh, see that? Lost Sawdust in that theater. To me, that...
That's a couple points for me, to be quite honest with you.
See, to me, that stuff fell a little flat. Like, I think that it was... I got what they were going for, but it just... It didn't really feel super believable to me, honestly. So I was a little out on that.
For me, dealing with a lot of my students are at-risk students.
Like, oh, okay. Yeah.
All of that was true. All of that was like the like, maybe that's why I was like that. There's the other part, and I'll get into the spoiler part, where the Freddie Freeman speech, mm-hmm. where he gives him a speech about why he is the way he acts, the way he acts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Was some real, real stuff you don't see in those kids' movies. Both those scenes were real kid stuff you don't see that, like, I was like, yeah, that's all true. That's all very, very realistically true. And, like, that was the moment where there was a lot of, like, uncomfortable parents and kids.
Yeah.
Because I think they all expected it to go a different way. Like, again, I don't want to spoil things, but, like, that Billy was going to have a much more cheery resolution that was going to buck him up to go save the day. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. There was something about it didn't play for me.
Well,
I don't know.
There were other parts I was more worried about. Like the part where they come out of the convenience store and they're really excited about getting the beer because you see it in the trailer.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
But they're 14-year-old boys who would want beer. And then, of course, they're also 14-year-old boys in this film universe who would think beer is disgusting and spit it out. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Or when they go to the strip club, I thought that could go really rough. Yet you just see them go... And then that stuff was dealt with
really well. I like that.
Yeah, because it's done with it's done through this lens of innocence. Like
exactly,
it's not overly lecherous. It's just it's more out of curiosity than anything else. And it felt to me that felt very true to like the characters. And I thought those were some of the funnier moments of the movie.
Mm. Yep.
It reminded me of tonally. And maybe kind of in general, because there's some kind of hairy stuff, and like the film I'm about to reference, it reminded me a little bit of like kind of a Goonies tone, where there's some stuff that's a little like naughty, I guess, but in the perspective of children who don't know what they're talking about, and then also you know some violence and some horror imagery, but used kind of more in a fantastical. In a fantastical sense, I think you know whether or not the movie is trying a lot of different things, and maybe sometimes it doesn't always work. But I really appreciate the ambition of the movie and the way that it's ambitious without feeling like it's running off the rails, trying to stuff in as much plot story as possible.
Yeah. I think it's the best possible way for DC to kind of course correct because it doesn't feel like they're course correcting. It just feels like they were trying to deliver a quality movie, you know, aimed at a younger audience. Like, and I loved that. I loved one of the moments that got to me. But Shazam is battling Dr. Savannah like in the sky, like they're having this epic battle and the kid with the action figure sees him and I was just like that's what like superheroes can represent, and so like that moment worked for me. There was another moment where like there's all this craziness and chaos and Shazam just takes a moment to like make sure this little girl's okay and like to comfort her instead of immediately going to fight the bad guy. And that was when I was like, God, Shazam's a better fucking Superman than Superman has been.
I had that thought multiple times, buddy, multiple times.
Yeah. 100%. So I loved all of that. I loved it worked so much better as a superhero as a genre than anything DC's put out in a long time.
Agreed.
Yeah, I just, I was, and it's such a fun movie. Like, I there were times when I caught myself thinking, like, what age is this meant for? But I didn't get too distracted because it just feels like it's meant to be fun. Like, it's meant to be a family movie that adults can watch with their kids and get jokes that the kids might not get, and the kids get fun and action and humor. And yeah, just like you said, Cass, in a way that movies just haven't really been able to do in a long time.
Well, I think that's why the 7 to 12 year old market has been ignored for about 15, 20 years.
Well, yeah, since
Pixar's been around.
Yeah.
Since the 7 to 10 year olds, you know, have grown up, now they're 30 year olds. It's nice to see. Yeah, movies are marketed that way. And that's part of why I liked Bumblebee so much is why I liked this so much.
They both kind of feel sort of throwbacky in a similar way. I also really liked how the movie uses Philadelphia as a city, as a character. I think that we really get a good sense of place in the movie. And it's, you know, obviously Hollywood likes to shoot in these sort of tertiary cities because they're cheaper. But I thought they used it in a really effective way.
Oh, buddy, I had a problem with that. Should have been Fawcett City.
Okay, I was gonna bring this up because
I had a problem with that, buddy.
So something that DC. I don't agree with that at all. Well, yeah. So I want to bring.
I got audibly upset at the beginning of the movie. My wife thought something was really wrong.
Well, that's like, something.
What's going on with this?
That's always been kind of a distinction between Marvel and DC. Marvel takes place in the real world in real cities. Mm-hmm. DC has this sort of imaginary. You know, they have Gotham, they have Metropolis, they have Star City, they have Coast City. You know, so I actually. I kind of agree with Patrick. It threw me because I was like, wait, this is a real city? But I mean, I've always preferred that about Marvel. So I got over it pretty quickly, especially since I don't have any real connection to Captain Marvel as a comic character.
Yeah.
I was like, eh, whatever.
I mean, I that's my hang up. Like, I used to have those books that were like the Atlas of the DC universe.
Yeah.
And I would transpose, like, I would steal a map of the United States from school and those transparencies that don't exist anymore. Mm. And I would transpose it and be like, okay, that's where Central City is. and like, this is where Star City would be. Coast City's obviously San Diego. Like, I would figure all that stuff out in my head. And it was like, when I saw that, I was like, no, man, this is like Indianapolis or Columbus or somewhere in like the Midwest. Yeah. This is not Philadelphia.
Okay, right. Let's.
I think that's good. Let's go ahead and grade it. I'm giving it a solid B.
Okay,
I enjoyed it a lot, though.
I'm giving it a B plus. I think I was more I think when I came out of the theater, it was closer to like a B minus. Mm-hmm. But just in thinking about it, and in thinking about sort of the path DC has been on, mm-hmm. This was so refreshing to me. I think
grading on a curve, it's like an A.
Right.
Well, yeah, I'm not grading on a curve. I'm just saying, like, the more I've thought about it, the more I've liked it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's I'm right next to Wonder Woman as far as like DC's recent efforts. So I'm giving it a B plus.
When I walked out, I said an A or an A minus. But when I sit back and think about it a little more in terms of just a film, not just as my expectations of this film that I thought it would have been, probably a B plus. Mm-hmm. Probably a little higher than you guys, but I really, you have no idea. I was like, I'm ready to slag this movie when I can sit down with you guys on Sunday.
I know that your cat enjoyed it.
A great deal. She needed you to go too.
Okay, let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework now, the Battered Bastards of Baseball that you assigned us, Patrick. And why don't you go ahead and describe what's happening in this documentary?
Okay, it's a rather short documentary. It came out in 2014 exclusively to Netflix, and I think there's a real specific reason why it can only go to Netflix and not ESPN. It is all about, in Portland, Oregon, in the mid-70s, 1973 to 1978, I believe.
Yeah, I think
there was the Portland Mavericks, and they were founded by Bing Russell, father of Kurt Russell. The film's directed, and I believe by, I think they're twin brothers, McCallan Way and Chapman Way, who are the grandchildren of Kurt Russell. And so they'd be the great-grandchildren of Bing Russell. Bing Russell was one of these, like, jobbers in Hollywood who, like, you, he was a, oh, that guy, like a character actor, really popular in Bonanza. And Kurt Russell, who's a major movie star now, was a great baseball prospect for the majors at the time. And there used to exist, like, a very clear tiered baseball league system where you'd have single A, double A, triple A. But at the same time, you had independent baseball, which is completely stomped out. And the film does a really good job of depicting how Major League Baseball stomps out independent baseball. And independent baseball was places like Portland, who were kind of medium-sized cities who did not have a large sports presence, could have a buyer come in, buy up an old stadium, and have really fun teams that you would go see. So like Flint would have, I used to know their names, would have like a baseball team. Indianapolis, before they became a major market, had like an independent team. And slowly Major League Baseball, and the film depicts this, is a lot of times people call it the NFL because of the acronym, the No Fun League. Major League Baseball is definitely more the No Fun League. In terms of slowing the game down, marketing the game for television, I think making the game very uniform, cookie cutter, following rules. Major League Baseball is very strict about like rebroadcast and who can do what and what can be shown. And at the same time, the film describes, there's this, I forget who the author is, a story, a book that comes out called Ball 4. And Ball 4 really takes Major League Baseball to task and the minor league system and independent baseball to task of how, like, how much drug use went on, how much fun it was, and how much the baseball system used up young kids and kind of threw them aside. And, like, this is kind of Bing Russell's last stand, the last independent baseball team, and they do really well, not only on the field, but marketing, like the city of Portland being this wild and zany. And the film slowly shows how Major League Baseball brings down top level talent when they play them, crushes them so they can't win a championship, and kind of squeezes him out financially near the end. And I wonder how much of this is also Bing Russell not doing the best job of like maintaining and marketing the team. But like, you know, of course, we only get one viewpoint of the documentary. And I was very curious to you guys, because I know you're not the biggest sports ball fans, but I know this also ties into like Hollywood and I think larger, like, I don't want to say political issues, but like system issues of how United States trusts and monopolies work.
Right. Yeah.
And how difficult it is to establish something that's
sort of an anti-corporate sentiment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the film, and I wonder what your take on the film was. Well,
for me personally, I was definitely kind of more drawn to the David and Goliath story.
I wondered,
certainly, yeah. And you know, I was interested in the Hollywood aspect of it, but I'm actually not that familiar with Bing Russell. I've seen Magnificent Seven, which he's in, but I've never really seen Bonanza or anything like that. I'm more familiar with like Kurt Russell's like Disney movies, like Computer Wore Tennis Shoes.
Did you know he was also a great baseball prospect?
I didn't know.
Oh, okay. I mean, he was supposedly going to be the next big star.
Yeah.
During the time, but then chose Hollywood instead, sided with his dad. Yeah. That's the urban legend goes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and which makes sense. Especially mm-hmm. when you see him in the archival footage of him on the field and stuff like that. I really enjoyed the kind of ragtag, you know, team of misfits kind of aspect of it.
It was like a real life version
of the Replacements.
The movie, The Replacements, yeah. Or Major League, mm-hmm. or I know they're kids, but the Bad News Bears, like,
right,
yeah.
I love a good ragamuffin takes on the establishment story.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think as a movie, this documentary definitely, it definitely tells that story effectively. So, like, and personally, I'm, you know, I could tell that this was made. I didn't realize the connection between the directors and Bing. I didn't know that. But like, once you see Kurt Russell up there and realize that that's his,
right,
you know, his son. Like, I'm not really watching this for necessarily historical accuracy. I'm at that point, I'm like, oh, okay, this is this is, you know, they're telling a story.
Yeah.
And so while I'm watching it, I'm more concerned with, does the story work?
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the documentary goes, I think it totally works. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've mentioned before that, you know, we're not huge into sports, but I like a good sports movie.
Sure.
Because yeah. you can get all the drama of the game, but like condensed into a 3-minute segment as opposed to a 4-hour live game.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I would have loved to have watched the Mavericks. I actually enjoy going to baseball games live. I won't watch them on TV. But like, I'm not like a huge diehard fan or anything, but I'm excited that our Padres are doing better this year. We live pretty close to the stadium. It's a great stadium.
Have you ever gone to a minor league, or we have independent baseball still here in Michigan, but have you ever gone to one of those smaller tier games?
No, because
you should. You should.
Yeah. After seeing this, I totally want to. Because I
mean, it's not this level, but sure. There's aspects of it still there. The wildness is still there.
When I lived in Phoenix, my mother worked at a pharmacy that a lot of like sports people, both players and managers and stuff like that would go to, and they would constantly mm-hmm. give the people who worked at this pharmacy comp okay. tickets. So we got to see like Phoenix Suns at the height of their thing when Charles Barkley was in the team. We got to see the Coyotes once, but we mostly saw AAA stuff. So we saw AAA hockey a lot, which was always my favorite thing. And then we also saw the Firebirds was their AAA baseball team. I saw that like a mm-hmm. couple times. And I agree. I always liked the AAA games more. And at the time, I didn't know why, but I think they were shorter because they weren't like cutting for commercial and stuff like that.
Yes.
Yeah. We actually have a few. This made me want to see other sports in San Diego live because we have a few. The only professional team we have anymore is the Padres, but there's like we have a hockey team, that's AAA, the goals. Mm-hmm. And I've heard those games are really fun.
Yeah. They're always super violent. People are fighting constantly.
Yeah.
That's why I like that and the froyo.
I would have loved to have gone to see a Mavericks game back in the day.
And the way that the film portrays them, like, you know, it's just one of the things I think the movie does really well is it kind of like captures like that 70s style and mood. Everybody's like hairy and mustaches and, you know,
chewing tobacco.
Even if they're like 23, they look 48.
And everyone's drinking
and smoking on the field and just nobody cares. So I like that kind of aspect of it. And I like sort of like the nostalgia of the 70s period. Like that always like works for me.
And I think this movie did a really good job of restoring some of that archival footage. Like it looks really gorgeous. And I even think there was some colorization put into because I have a feeling I don't know. The film stock, it was definitely restored in some way, but it looks really good. So watching that like archival footage was really fun. And I don't know. I think Cassidy and I, we've talked about this a little bit, but I don't know if I've really done a good job emphasizing my love for Kurt Russell on this podcast. I love Kurt Russell. I think he's one of the few like bona fide like movie stars in my mind. As soon as he popped up on the screen, I was like, what the fuck is this movie? But you know, like just hearing him talk about you know, this game that he clearly loved so much and this thing that he was doing with his dad, like that to me was a really good like emotional hook to get me into the end of the movie.
Right.
I mean, full disclosure, I love baseball. One of the things that are our least downloaded shows Dennis and I do in Most Education are baseball related shows. But like I love baseball. On a meta level, I think was really interesting about this film, which is not on the in the film, but if you know enough about, I guess, ESPN and baseball in general, it's the stuff that's not there. Mm-hmm. 2014 was like Bill Simmons had all those 30 for 30 sports, mm-hmm. ESPN. Like, this would have been primed for one of those.
Right.
Yeah.
But I know exactly why it wasn't, because it's super critical of Major League Baseball.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Not just of the time, but like a contemporary baseball.
Yeah, the entire establishment, because, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And this would have been one of those that went on 30 for 30. It would have won some award because it had Kurt Russell in it. And it was going to be some directorial debut. That would have been great. And there's a guy in the movie who's the bat boy, Todd Phillips.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Todd Field. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Different director.
different director. Yeah. Who's a director did Little Children and is like one of those Hollywood guys who writes and directs mm-hmm. stuff. I think he's won Oscars, right?
He's won Oscars for both Little Children and In the Bedroom.
You're right. And he also invented Big League Chew. So if you ever see Big League Chew,
I know.
He's also the guy.
I thought that was fun.
But he does a really great job of explaining, like, I don't think. But me, I'm too young to know this, but like people 10 years older than me would know this in their mid to late 40s, that this is how baseball used to be before mm-hmm. it's been completely slowed down, before the home run hitting and a million commercial breaks and, you know, pricing an average person out and the game stretching out to 5 hours long. Like, this is like all baseball used to be played quick and fun and aggressive. And the guy would pitch six innings and they'd have no reliever and they didn't care about commercial breaks. Like, that was how baseball was. And like, one of the reasons baseball has fallen out of favor, I think, in the American pop culture is everything they've done to themselves of just being greedy corporate monsters who just need to squeeze every dime out of the game they possibly can mm-hmm. with ad revenue and just kill themselves and then turn around and look and say like, well, Americans don't like baseball anymore because it's too slow. And it's, well, you've slowed the game down through greed. I think the film, without hitting you over the head, as a baseball fan, I watch and go like, oh yeah, they're right. Like, they're so right, that message in the film of like, this is how baseball used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the,
sorry, they're soapbox. I'm off.
No,
my soapbox.
No, no. I think that's good. And the movie is all about sort of that turning point, because, you know, yeah. as soon as 1978 rolls around and he loses that team, that kind of like establishes a new era of an even more yeah. corporatized, commercialized baseball.
Product.
Yeah.
Product. I mean, they say all the time, the game's a product now. Mm-hmm. The MLB calls it the product.
Yeah.
It's not no longer called a game.
Ugh, gross. Yeah. No, I'm with you. I think if baseball was still like this, I would probably be a lot more interested. Like I said, I still enjoy going to Padres games. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I like give me, you know, just even the title of the battered bastards of baseball, like,
right.
there did used to be this sort of like ragamuffin, you know, like tough kid vibe to baseball. Mm. I think it sucks that's kind of gone away. And yeah, you know, fuck the establishment, fuck the man. I loved that this is a story about an independent thing, you know, whether it's baseball or movies or whatever. Mm-hmm. I love the story of something independent, something outside the establishment, fucking crushing the establishment. I love it. Anytime you get that with, like, you know, you hear about the movies that, you know, nobody expected to do well, and then it dominates the box office or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like any medium, anything you're talking about, like I love it when passion,
the camp fight, City Hall, David and Goliath,
right?
Just like
fight the man kind of thing.
Like, it's okay to just do something because you enjoy it. Uh-huh. You know, you don't have to figure out a way to monetize it. You don't have to, like, these guys weren't pulling in huge fucking crazy baseball salaries. They were making like $400 a week, but they loved it because they were getting paid enough to do the thing they love to do.
Right. And a lot of the players were actually from other teams that they were kicked out of or couldn't make right. or whatever.
Yeah.
A couple points of criticism before we kind of finish out here. I do think it relies on talking head, straight to camera mm-hmm. stuff a little too much. I would have actually liked mm-hmm. to see more archival footage and less commentary.
I
to
kind
of tell
that.
The story. Yeah. It took a little while for the story aspect of it to coalesce. They talk a lot about Bing Russell and his career yes. at the front of the film. But I guess we need that established yeah. a little bit. But and finally, and this isn't even really a criticism, but I think that this actually is strong enough as a story that I think it would actually work better as narrative than as documentary.
I agree. I actually was like, how has this not been turned into a Replacements type movie yet?
Maybe
like,
for the reasons Patrick brought up.
Major League Baseball would sue them into the ground if they tried to be.
But
I talked about Ball 4 has been like in developmental hell forever because Major League Baseball no way would let that come out.
I mean, I guess the closest thing we have to that is Major League. So if right. you want a sort of scripted sort of version of this, rewatch Major League. Mm-hmm. But I just like this is ripe for.
Yeah, because you got fun characters, and also you can you could have Zac Efron come on as a young Kurt Russell, and even plays into their like Disney pasts.
That'd be fucking great. I agree with you. I was like, why is this not just a movie? But I don't know. Maybe Netflix right. could make the doc.
I mean,
on
do you remember how much? Shit that movie Concussion got. I mean, yes. they yeah. buried that. And I don't know. I never saw yeah. it. It might not be that good of a movie, but.
And that's exactly why I hate sports, Patrick. It's not the sport itself. It's the monetization of it. Mm-hmm. The sucking any sort of integrity out of any game.
$12 hot dogs.
I'm not even blaming the food. Like, the concessions or whatever, like, I don't care. The stadium's gotta stay open. But like the over corporatization, the over commercialization, the way it's more of a brand than anything. Mm-hmm. And they sell, they can sell each individual team, each individual franchise as its own brand.
Yeah. They can trade off members like they're slaves.
there's a lot of things wrong with it. But one of the problems with getting a sports movie made that is critical of a league, I always think is the audience watches most of their sports through ESPN or like a Fox affiliate.
Yeah.
And those are like the only two outlets. So all your advertising would go towards those.
Well, and all Disney now too. So.
And the second you did that, a lot of the sports, whatever sports league did, would say, hey, why are we running why are we giving you instead of whatever Fox Sports our exclusive rights or CBS our exclusive rights to run our stuff? If you're going to run all these critical ads of us, this thing, or interview this guy about it. And I think it does squeeze them out a great deal. And you did see that with the Concussion film. What was it called?
Concussion.
Concussion. Well, maybe part of the problem with the movie's called Concussion, too.
Well,
what's that Concussion movie? Concussion?
Tell the truth.
Starring Concussion?
Tell the truth. I mean, here's hoping that some, in the spirit of independence, some independent filmmaker comes in and funds it on their own dime. Like, I could see it being a hit.
Hey, Todd Field, why don't you come out of hiding and make a goddamn another movie since you haven't made a movie since Little Children, which was like 2006, and you showed promise of being one of our greatest directors after making two amazing movies that were Oscar nominated and then disappeared.
Yeah. Like, let's
got that big league chew money.
I would love to see that, to see it in the spirit of the Mavericks. I'm putting a bounty out on any independent filmmaker. And it's a thing. It's a fucking baseball movie. You could make that so cheap nowadays.
Yeah. True. All right. That is the episode. If anybody has anything to say about anything that we have talked about today, you can email us at Let me try that again. Said the name that should not be mentioned. You can email us at MacGuffinPod@gmail.com. Patrick, I'm going to let you say all your stuff first.
Oh, I mean, honestly, like, just Google Almost Educational, and the first thing that comes up is like four or five hits. I did this on an incognito on Google to see if like they weren't tracking me. Like, just type in Almost Educational. It's a podcast that are thought experiments on nonsense.
Nice SEO.
Thank you very much. So go ahead and check it out. It's got a topic that I guarantee you'll enjoy. If you found me charming in any way, then you'll enjoy the show. Dennis, I don't know, or the guest, I don't know so much. But me, I'm at least charming.
I enjoy both of you. I like the chemistry, which is what always makes for a great podcast. Be sure to follow us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Pocket Cast, and Player.fm. We're still trying to get on Google Play and all the other stuff, but we are definitely accessible. You can find us on Twitter, at MacGuffinPod, on Instagram, at MacGuffinPod, and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/MacGuffinPod to see all of our news stories that we cover, as well as when we post episodes and questions that we pose to the listeners. You can follow me individually on Twitter at BC Cassidy, and you can read my writing that I do for the Idaho State Journal at the idahostatejournal.com. We're under the arts and entertainment section. There's a movie tab somewhere. And what else? You can read my writing that I do for the Seattle-based movie website, The MacGuffin, at macguff.in/author/Cassidy. While you're there, go ahead and read the other articles and reviews by the MacGuffin staff. Keith.
www.keithfosterkid for all my upcoming live shows and performances. You can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram at keithfosterkid. That's it.
Okay. Be sure to check out all of our other friends out there making their own podcasts. Independent podcasts. We're no sellouts over here. Including Almost Educational with Patrick and Dennis. Bill and
I would sell out in a minute.
Huh? You, like, oh, yeah, me too.
I would sell out. Yeah,
I'm just,
sell
yeah,
out in a minute. I want,
it's not even considered selling out. I'm considered propositioning myself.
Yeah. Like last week when you read an ad for Cirque du Soleil.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Speaking of, Volta by Cirque du Soleil is still running at the Del Mar Fairgrounds. Get your tickets now.
And Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast, Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places, and Rogue Fun, the Star Wars podcast, and Mike Fallick over at Hack Thought. And Keith, you just recently did an episode with Adam Connie over at the Adamant podcast. I listened to it.
That's right.
Keith dropped some serious reveals. Some serious reveals.
I actually wasn't going to plug it on this podcast because I think we have more listeners. So thanks for that, Cassidy. But yeah, we get real. We talk some shit. So
talking about the issues.
Yeah, Jesus, why did you bring it?
And
here's the thing. It came up. It would have got weird if I didn't talk about it.
Okay. So if anyone's really interested to hear what that's all about, check out the last episode or last episode of the Adamant podcast.
Please cut all of this out. Like I begged him to do so.
Oh no.
Oh, Patrick, Lord, I'm gonna get fired.
Thank you for coming on. And is there anything else you have to say?
I was gonna try to be pithy and get myself a cold open. Midwest nice. This is nice. Thank you, fellas.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Shazam!